broadcasting worldwide from the beautiful hill country in Texas. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. This is Patrick Timpone. Another day in paradise. As we broadcast live here from Central Texas in the hill country, about an hour west of Austin, Texas, worldwide on OneRadioNetwork.com. OneRadioNetwork.com. Andrew Goss on Wednesday and Dr. Richard Massey on Thursday, Open Phone Friday. So we're going to have a big time this weekend, or this week. Thanks to Sharon for setting up all these cool people. Thanks to you for joining us, and here's how you can participate. 888-663-6386. Don't be shy. 888-663-6386. Email Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. Sharon put a video up this weekend about our first guest, author Fletcher, his website, InclinedBedTherapy.com. It's a very simple idea that he says might do some really wonderful things for you. Inclined Bed Therapy, IBT. Andrew Fletcher is in southwest Devon, England, where he said it's 28 degrees Celsius. Not sure what that is, but it sounds pretty good. Haven't figured that out. I guess that's about 55, 60 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And I think it's probably maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, something like that. Mr. Fletcher, good afternoon there in England.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I don't have my Celsius Fahrenheit thing, but I'll figure it out sometime this morning.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you.
Uh-huh. We put that video on our website. Quite interesting. How long have you been... And you're a former engineer, right? And not a
medical. That's right.
You're not a medical guy. How'd you come up with the idea that in putting your head up 6 inches will help us?
Well, it's an incredible story. Everything you're about to hear is the truth. One of my skills is a lateral thinker, which is a bit of a penalty at times. Because you start off in one direction and you end up in a completely different direction that you never anticipated.
Uh-huh.
And that's exactly what happened here. I made the stupid decision to ask how trees raise water from the ground to the leaf.
Yeah.
I was involved in an irrigation project at the time, still am, and that project aims to induce rainfall in arid regions.
Hmm.
One of the problems you get when you're irrigating arid regions is you get a build-up of salt on the soil, and that poisons the soil, so you have to move somewhere else and practice your irrigation elsewhere. But I noticed that trees were standing there, and they'd been there for sometimes hundreds of years, so they weren't affected by the salt, and there wasn't the salt around the base of the tree. The question I asked was, what are these trees doing with the salts? That was how I approached the problem. So I travelled off to a car boot sale and stumbled across a GCSE biology book by D.G. McKean. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. For 20 pence, I'll have a read. And I read an incredible amount of I'll let your readers interpret some of the bits that I read, which actually prompted me to look into circulation in trees. One of the points was water evaporates from the leaves and causes a kind of suction, which pulls water up the stem. Now, for an engineer, a kind of suction that pulls water up the tree doesn't sit very well. Well, I won't bore
go ahead.
Readers.
No,
okay,
we want the whole story. So actually, what happens with what you learned that the leaves? What happens? How does it get to sucking the water up from the ground?
Okay. Well, it says many biologists regard transpiration as an inevitable consequence of photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
In order to photosynthesize, the leaf has to take in carbon dioxide from the air, the pathway which allows carbon dioxide in will also let water vapor out. So okay. It's an inevitable loss of water that serves little purpose other than heat regulation. So anyway, there was quite a bit that I read in the book. For example, another point, you may have learned in physics that you cannot draw water up by suction to a height of more than about 10 meters. Many taller trees than this don't appear to have a problem with drawing water higher than 10 meters.
They don't appear to have a problem.
So that's a bad statement in the book. And in fact, it was D.G. McKean's, the honesty that the man gave when he put the book together, describing a wholly inadequate explanation for fluid transport in trees, that fired me up, and the solution came to me within 20 minutes. Now, what I did, arrogantly if you like, I ignored all of the explanations that had come before and just re-examined the facts. And the fact that I saw was that the tree stood above ground level and was growing predominantly vertical. So it was obviously benefiting in some way from gravity, otherwise it would be growing horizontally.
Mm-hmm.
And it contains a multi-conduit of tubes, so the tubes run from root to leaf. And we know we have an upflow predominantly in the xylem and a downflow predominantly in the phloem. And the phloem is always loaded with denser materials, and the xylem sap is always more dilute because it draws water in from the soil. So this is how I put it together. 98% of all the water evaporates through the leaves, and this will you need to learn this to understand why we tilted the beds, yeah? So 98% of all the water evaporates through the leaves. That's a fact. I have no problem with that.
So in other words, let me stop you a second. So it comes up from the roots deep down, comes up, and then leaves and comes out as humidity in the air.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
That's why that's why places with lots of trees are humid.
That's correct. That's called transpiration.
Okay.
But what science had forgotten is that for every action, there's a reaction. You cannot boil away or evaporate away 98% of all of the water without actually concentrating the sap.
Okay.
Are you with me? So you're effectively boiling water away as evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever's left behind is increased by 98%. And because the leaves produce sugar, converting carbon dioxide through photosynthesis into sugars, yeah?
Okay.
That's denser than water. And the mineral salts and nutrients brought into the xylem are also denser than water. So the massive loss of moisture from the leaf changes the density of the sap at the top of the tree.
Okay.
Gravity dictates that denser sap will move towards a sink. That sink can be a fruit, or it can be the trunk, you know, as a store.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can actually travel right down to the roots and then get re-diluted by incoming water from the soil. So that ensures that the upward flow is always more dilute than the downward flow.
Okay.
So if science had asked the right question instead of the wrong question, and the wrong question is how does water get from the roots to the leaves, what they should have asked is how do trees circulate water? And then the answer would have been clear.
They circulate the water by releasing, taking the CO2 from the air.
Yes.
And then they evaporate, the water goes out in the air, and that creates a sugar or sap that either goes into a fruit or back into the tree, like in a pine tree.
Yes.
Or a maple tree.
Yes.
Okay.
And for every action, there's a reaction. You can't have a downward flow without generating a return flow. So if you can picture this sap inside the tree behaving like string rather than like a liquid, every molecule is attached to the molecule behind it. So as you stimulate a downflow, it creates molecular drag. That molecular drag affects all of the sap in the tree. It affects the return flow and the downflow. Now, in order to demonstrate this circulation system, I set up a simple experiment at Brixham Cliffs in the Overgang car park, not too far from me. And we caused water to flow up a cliff to 24 meters using only a pinch of salt, about 10 milliliters of salt. We had a single length of 6-millimeter bore tube. Both ends were pushed into two bottles of water. The tube itself contained boiled water to remove any gas bubbles. And the water inside the vessels at ground level also contained boiled water to remove the gas bubbles. And a tiny amount of salt solution was added to the centre of the tube, which was then raised up the cliff to 24 metres, more than twice what they say is possible in physics. And the water was suspended. I had scientists there from the Forestry Commission. We had journalists there. Everyone witnessed the experiment. It was a great success. It stayed suspended there for about 15, 20 minutes.
Hmm.
And the downward flow in the one side caused we used two demijohns or two fermenting bottles. One bottle was overflowing slowly and the other bottle was going down.
So
that tiny amount of salt solution lifted thousands of times its own volume effortlessly, 24 metres. And when we did that, that was by no means the first time that I'd performed that experiment. When I first saw that experiment, I knew that I'd nailed something really important. And I knew that the physics behind it had no respect for the vessel that contained it. So the leap from trees to humans and animals was the next step.
Wow.
As I explained at the start of the interview.
Yeah, so
being a lateral thinker, it's
a lateral thing. So you were able to actually raise water 24 meters just using salt?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
That's amazing. Just because what goes up, something else has got to go down.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So what does that then tell us about the human body?
It tells us a great deal. As I said, it has no respect for the vessel that contains it. So any column of water that stands above ground level and evaporates most of the water from the surface or from the upper part would change the density of whatever sap or blood that was supplying it. And in the case of the body, the blood that passes through the lungs supplies the fluid that we evaporate with every breath.
Mm-hmm.
So the blood that passes through the lungs becomes denser and then passes through the heart and then re-enters the main artery. So it's the equivalent for every breath we take to placing a pinch of salt in the blood in the arteries. So gravity will act upon that and draw it down towards the kidneys. The kidneys are great at filtering out salts and other waste. So the blood that passes through the kidneys becomes less dense as the salt's excreted in the urine. So therefore, the return flow blood is always less dense than the downward flowing arterial blood.
Hmm.
And again, the flow and return system fitted exactly with the way the body was. And I had a meeting with two vascular surgeons over at Torquay. One guy was Peter Lewis, vascular surgeon. And the other guy was Celeste, another vascular surgeon from Trinidad, I think he was. And I showed them the experiment, because you can do a smaller benchtop model rather than stringing tubes up the cliff. So anyone can do this this experiment at home. And Peter's reaction was, "My God," he said, "I thought pure science was dead." He said, "And here it is on my kitchen table. What you have explained to me fits exactly with everything that we know about circulation in the body."
So, go back to the idea of the salts and the breath. Where does the salt come from?
The salt is from our diet. So
okay.
we take in a dilute soup of nutrients into the blood, just like the trees take in a dilute soup of nutrients from the soil.
Mm-hmm.
That passes through the lungs, and we have iron in the blood as well, which is also denser than, well, anything that's denser than water, really. So as soon as you start evaporating water from that liquid, you make it denser. And as soon as you make it denser, gravity will act upon the denser side. And in this case, it's the arteries. So I questioned, how could we make use of this discovery?
Mm-hmm.
So the obvious thing was, well, wow, it's easy to understand why the most successful species on Earth stands the most vertical, ourselves and trees. And I questioned why we sleep flat, because it made no sense now. And I thought, well, what would happen if we raised the head of the bed? How much would we need to raise the head of the bed? So what I did was I got a loop of tubing, closed loop of tubing filled with water. Added some coloured salt solution to the pillow end of the loop of tubing, which stretched down the entire length of the bed. I then raised the bed up in increments to see which would be the ideal for comfort and for circulation.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to about 4.5 inches, the flow was down one side of the tube and the return flow was in the same side of the tube. So I could see the coloured solution flowing down the one side and the return flow going back over the top of it. So there was a two-directional flow in one side of the tube with no overall rotation. When the bed was raised up to 5 inches, then I started to see the circulation. So we added an extra inch for good measure. And I had the flow, which represented the arterial flow, and the return flow, which represented the vascular return, or the venous return flow. Then we tilted our bed, and I was really excited about this. My wife thought I was insane.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But she agreed, and we tilted the bed, and we started to imagine things. Like we had more energy, we felt a little bit fitter. We had a stiff neck as well, and some extra aches and pains, as if we'd been working out in the gymnasium, but we hadn't. And I had a meeting with a guy called Leon Corral down the Pocket Bookshop, and I was discussing the discovery with him, and he was excited too. And then a nurse butted in, Stephanie Ness, and she said, I don't interrupt conversations very often, she said, but this is very exciting. She said, I'm a nurse, and I'm in charge with all of the local elderly patients. And we've known for a long time that the elderly people that spend a long time in bed don't live very long. But those that refuse to lie down in bed actually seem to go on into their hundreds.
Well,
most of them, she said, sat in chairs and refused to get into bed.
Oh, they didn't want to go in.
So they knew there was something wrong with lying down. They felt uncomfortable, which was fascinating. And then she said, I wonder if it would work for varicose veins. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Because if we've applied pressure, increased the pressure in the arteries, which the theory dictates would happen, and indeed, Peter Lewis and Celeste agreed with that principle, then it would apply tension to the blood in the veins, and it would also lower the pressure in the veins, which would pull the veins in. So when I got home, I asked my wife to lift up a trouser leg. And lo and behold, a varicose vein that had been there for 16 years had gone flat with no surgery. Now, that's interesting because...
You know, it's just counterintuitive because you think, well, if your head is higher, Andrew, then you're going to have more blood flowing down to your legs, which is a coagulation of blood in your veins, right? So
yes.
It's just like the opposite of what you would think it would be.
But as we discussed in the treatise, the question wasn't how water... shouldn't have been how water is raised from the roots to the leaves.
It goes the other way.
Because it's circular. Now, if you've got circulation, you can increase the circulation or you can decrease the circulation. But unless you chop someone's foot off, blood won't flow down and out.
Yeah.
Yeah? We have a flow and a return system, a venous return and an arterial flow.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a misconception.
Sure.
I think what they're referring to is the flow of excess fluids from the veins out into the surrounding tissue. So that happens when the pressure inside the veins is greater, and that causes the fluid to migrate from the blood out into the surrounding tissue, causing edema. Yeah.
Sure.
Or fluid retention.
Right.
Now that was the other condition that improved. I started to look around for people with varicose veins and looking at women's legs for all the wrong reasons.
That's right. Yeah. I understand.
Or all the right reasons, depending on your standpoint. I got my mother to take part. But in the meantime, Stephanie Ness had reported that her varicose vein had improved as well and was hardly visible.
And how long?
She's a nurse.
How long?
4 weeks.
4 weeks.
Both my wife and both Stephanie Ness, 4 weeks.
The common conventional wisdom about varicose veins, if I understand, is something like they have these little flaps in the veins that are supposed to kind of... The valves, they kind of move up and hold, and these things get kind of weak somehow with something's weak in the arteries, you know, lack of nutrients or something, and then the blood kind of pools down there. If that's correct, why would your, and I don't know if that is correct, I mean, that's just conventional wisdom.
Yes.
You know, that's what the docs say anyway, or the natural doctors even. Why would raising the head affect that?
That's interesting.
I mean, again, I don't know if the flap thing is a viable premise.
What it is there's two angled. There's an angled flap of vein,
mm-hmm.
which allows blood to pass through it, and then it stops the return flow.
Right, it's supposed to flap up and stop.
So
the
it's
return.
Like a one way, like a one way valve.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. I mean, the answer is, you know, if these, both my wife and there are many others that have also reported the improvements in varicose veins,
mm-hmm.
who probably have those damaged valves,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
have noticed that their veins have gone flat also.
Mm-hmm.
There is photographic evidence on the internet showing a young gentleman who provided us with a fantastic photographic account of how his veins changed over a period of a couple of years.
I'll be done.
And it was incredible. It was absolutely... I mean, the guy wore support stockings and always wore trousers. He's been out on the beach in shorts.
So the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, hopefully, yes. I mean, certainly we need a study into varicose veins, a study into edema, you know, to actually determine whether this is just a fluke or you know, whether it's more than anecdotal evidence.
Yeah, yeah. 24 minutes after the hour with Andrew Fletcher, Sharon says it's 82 degrees where you are. She did the Fahrenheit. She also suggested, and this would be fun, and I'm going to do it, so that if our listeners want to do this, and we'll talk about exactly how to do it before the show, and raise the head of your bed, and then we'll have Andrew back on in 3 months or so, and get listeners to write in and call in and see what kind of, how about that? Would that be
that
fun?
That sounds very good.
That'd be fun, yeah. And so we'll get exactly what to do and how to do it before the end of the show. And if you'd like to participate, I'm going to do it. I'll do it today, and Sharon's going to do it, and we'll just do it and see what we see. Okay, Andrew Fletcher is with us. His website is, let me see, let me grab it here. I want to just get it for you. It's inclinedbedtherapy.com, inclinedbedtherapy.com. So what do you think the effect, how has this affected your sleep? And how long have you been doing it?
Since 1994.
Wow, you've been doing it for 20 years?
Not as long as the ancient Egyptians.
They slept like this?
Yes.
Did they?
I mean, it's a great idea, you know, but you need to know if someone else has done it before. So you go back in history, and the evidence is overwhelming, but providing you're looking in the right places.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the tomb robbers went in, they had jewels and gold in their eyes, and obviously paid no attention to the fact that all of the beds were inclined.
Hmm.
They were raised exactly 6 inches at the head end.
I'll be done.
When I asked the curator at the Boston Museum to go out with a tape measure, she measured one, and she said it's exactly 6 inches at the head end.
Isn't
exactly the same measurement that I come up with using a tube.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, but it goes even further back than that.
Mm-hmm.
We've been swaddling babies in swaddling clothes. Even Jesus was documented to be swaddled in a manger.
Yes,
yeah?
sir.
And, you know, the only reason you would swaddle a child is to stop them moving, and the only reason you would stop them moving is for sliding down the bed. And there are pictures abounding on the internet of swaddle babies on inclined planes.
Really?
Yes.
So you think that's why we swaddle them, because to keep them from sliding down?
Yes.
Huh. That's pretty cool. Kind of got goosebumps there. That's kind of neat.
Well, I've touched the tip of the iceberg because, as I said, I was a lateral thinker. So the next thing I did, I got my mother to tilt her bed.
Mm-hmm.
She had very bad varicose veins. Took a long while to convince her that, it wasn't... I was being sensible. We tilted the bed, and in 4 weeks, I got a phone call from my mum, and she said, can you tell me what this bed's all about? I said, look, mum, I've explained in great detail. She said, just run it by me once more. I said, you've got something to tell me about your varicose veins? She said, oh, yeah. She said, but that's not why I'm ringing. Oh? I said, tell me more. She said, I'm standing here by the phone, twiddling my toes, moving my ankle on my left leg. I said, but do you want a round of applause? She said, I haven't done that for 11 years.
She hasn't moved her toes for 11 years?
No.
Whoa.
And I thought, wow, we're not just looking at blood circulation now. That must be a neurological problem. So again, I found another book and started to dig into how cerebrospinal fluid circulates.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, just like the trees, no one really knows. They know it's linked to posture, and they know it's linked to respiration, and they know that the heart doesn't play a role any more than it plays a role in the lymphatic system.
Mm-hmm.
So something's driving this circulation, and it fitted perfectly with what I discovered, because the evaporation from the sinuses and from the eyes and from the skin changes the density of the fluids that flow through it. So we're constantly changing the density of the cerebrospinal fluid, which means that the downflow is always more dense than the return flow. And a recent paper has just been published that actually states that this is correct, that the downflow is always denser than the return flow.
So
you put it down to a thermohaline difference, much the same as you've got the thermohaline flow in the mm-hmm. in the Atlantic Ocean, yeah, the Atlantic conveyor belt. The ocean currents are driven thought to be driven by a thermohaline, which is a change in density due to heat. But if you think about it logically for a second, you would need a tremendous amount of energy from the sun to change the density of the ocean. But what you'd need to do is evaporate water from the Earth's surface, from the ocean surface, which then induces the same flow and return system that powers all of the ocean currents.
Yes. So yeah. Our body does the same thing with our eyes and our nose and our lungs. It puts off CO2, just like the trees, and
yes.
that's what causes the blood to keep moving while we're laying down.
What happens?
Or it's all the time. It's not the heart, right? It's not the heart pumping.
Well,
I mean, because docs have told us the heart really isn't a pump. That it's just gravity and stuff that's really moving everything around.
Right, we have got a heart, yes. And I'll bow down to that. But,
okay.
But, yes, when we're conceived, there is no heart pumping. And yet circulation takes place. If we take a chicken's egg, for
that's
example.
That's right, yeah, from the very beginning.
Yes, if we take a chicken's egg, for example, we know that the food is in the yolk.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got the albumen around the egg.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from hatcheries that you must rotate those eggs. And we know that the shape of the egg dictates that it'll only rotate across one axis. So if rotating the egg is important, then what that tells us is that gravity is playing a role. And I suggest that the downward flow from the food source actually triggers a return flow, and this is how the initial circulation takes place. Long before the heart is formed and beats, there's a pulsatile flow in that primary circulation inside the egg. And in the case of a mother who's expecting a baby, then that depends on the posture of the mother. So if the mother's always moving around, it's the same equivalent as the chicken's egg being rotated.
So it's probably good to exercise when you're pregnant or do something,
absolutely.
Walk or what?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What happened next was, because I thought, if you want to stop me, just stop, because I could rabbit on about this.
Rabbit on. Well, just rabbit on. Well, let's rabbit on with a couple commercials. And then we'll let you wrap it on some more. Okay. 28 before the hour. Man, don't you just love these kind of fascinating people? This is OneRadioNetwork.com. It's 19 before the hour. Talking with an interesting man. He is in England, South Devon. Andrew Fletcher, inclinedbedtherapy.com. About raising your bed 6 inches. So, can we just take some books and get a tape measure? And,
yes.
And Julian, just raise our bed 6 inches and try this for 3 months and see what we see, see what we feel?
Yeah. Yes, I reckon the best books to use for raising a bed are medical books.
Yeah, I think so. I got a lot of those. those big, thick ones. Sometimes you probably just need about 2 of them and just do 6 inches. Is it critical to get exactly 6 inches?
In the American beds are bigger than the beds over in the UK, so yeah. I would recommend if your bed's sort of bigger than, say, 6'3", 6'4", mm-hmm. you would need to raise your bed 6.5, 7 inches.
Oh, let's see. Oh, okay, you mean lengthwise?
Yes.
If it's over about 6 feet or so?
Yes. Oh. Well, they'll be over 6 feet, yes.
I don't think, yeah. But around in there, 6 inches is going to be good for most people?
Yes.
And what kind of improvements do you think they're going to see? And we're going to have them try it and talk to you again.
Well, we're going to get improvements in spouses stopping snoring. We're going to have improvements in better oxygenation. For a kickoff, I conducted this experiment with sleeping dogs as well as sleeping humans.
Really?
You'll get a decrease in respiration rate by 4 to 5 breaths per minute.
Really?
You'll get a decrease in heart rate by 10 to 12 beats per minute. Your circulation will increase. People that suffer with cold hands and cold feet in bed mm-hmm. will find they'll be sleeping with the feet outside of the bed because they'll get nice and warm.
Mm-hmm.
You'll skip getting a lot of colds and influenza, and if you do get the infections, you'll seem to... We all seem to be fighting them off a lot better. My lovely granddaughter, Amy... she's at infant school, and the entire class went down with chicken pox, except Amy didn't get it.
Hmm.
So the there is a great deal of
we don't know what's going on with the immune system, then, do we? I mean,
well,
the benefits, or do you?
If we take the immune system alone, if we take gravity away, for example, put an astronaut in space, peak of fitness. What happens is they start to age 10 times faster than they do here on Earth.
Huh. Oh, yeah, with the astronauts. Yeah, we've heard about that.
Yeah, the bones decalcify, muscles atrophy away, the heart atrophies away,
mm-hmm.
Neurological problems, a tremendous amount of problems, long-lasting problems as well. Some of the long-term spaceflight astronauts, one guy in particular from Russia, It's taken, I think John Vernikos said it was at 20, I'm not sure, it was 18 years. Hang on, I might have that written down somewhere. For the full recovery from just being in space.
You know, that's when they first kind of came up with these little small rebounders that we promote. For 20 years, because they lost all this bone density from space.
Yes.
And when you jump up and down and you get about a foot off the mat, it builds a bone density.
Yes, and so does inclined bed therapy.
So does inclined bed therapy.
I had a lady contact me, and a lady called Ruby Tate. Uh-huh. She's appeared on TV, so she won't mind me mentioning the name.
Mm-hmm.
She had osteoporosis. She couldn't turn over in bed. Tremendous problems. She couldn't clothe herself properly. Turning over in bed was a mammoth task. She couldn't turn around. She had to turn her whole body around to view a clock behind her. It completely cleared the osteoporosis.
Let me ask you this. Say if somebody has a relative in a nursing home, I've noticed some of the nursing homes, they have the people sleeping even higher than that, you know, where they might be at 45-degree angle.
Yes.
Would that be preferable, or would you recommend keeping
grandma? I know what you're going to say.
Okay.
Yeah? Yeah, I think you're referring to the beds being raised at the upper half raised with the legs either flat or the legs raised.
Correct.
Okay, as you would it with an adjustable bed, a mechanical adjustable.
Yeah, they put them in hospitals and nursing homes and stuff like that.
Yeah, totally wrong posture.
Oh, really?
Probably going to cause more problems. Sleeping on an incline bed, for example, decompresses the spine because if you can imagine your weight's shifted, so it's trying to slide down the bed, but it's held back by the friction between yourself and the mattress.
Of course.
This applies traction to the spine, so relieves the most back problems will get relieved, yeah? But if you're in a sitting position, which you've just described, raising the upper half and keeping the legs either flat or raised, what we've done there now, the pelvis is actually pressing down on the soft tissue.
Yes.
So it's going to risk causing pressure sores. We've created a loop by having the knees bent, so that's going to prevent fluids from returning back into the main circulatory system, so we're going to get swollen ankles.
Good.
No. Sitting posture, according to Joan Vernikos, who was former head of life sciences at NASA, she recommends that everyone should stand for 20 minutes. Every 20 minutes should stand up.
Yeah, we've had Joan on the show.
Oh, you have? Oh.
Yeah, years ago. Maybe last year. So even in the nursing home, if you had a bed that where the top half raises up with a lever or whatever they do, and if you did that 6 inches, that still doesn't do what you want to do.
No.
You'd want to keep it flat and just raise it and get the whole thing on an incline, and that would include or improve circulation.
Yes.
You think that'd help somebody with a stroke?
Yes.
Wow.
It would. I'm trying to make sure that I don't forget everything here, but there's a child locally with an enlarged dysfunction in pituitary gland, which resulted in paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
We were told that there would be no recovery, or the parents were told there would be no recovery, because the pituitary gland drives everything in the body.
Yes.
This child is down the gymnasium.
I'm sorry?
He's down the gymnasium working out. He's regained function of his legs and his arms.
Just from inclined bed therapy?
Yes.
No kidding.
Multiple sclerosis. This is where the research went the next turning, because my mother had reported improvements in the leg. I looked into multiple sclerosis and did a preliminary study with a gentleman who's a fellow engineer. Who started to notice improvements, and Roger was in the advanced stage of multiple sclerosis, Roger Kirk. He's passed away recently.
Mm-hmm.
This guy actually gets out of his wheelchair and stands by his wheelchair. It was featured in the Daily Mail, which is a local newspaper. He actually wrote that he got out of his car and walked. He could never have done that.
Andrew,
that led on to doing another extended research with a group of people with MS. I went to a local chapter in Kingstainton locally and took Roger along with me. He explained all the things that had been happening to him, including stopping his hair loss, better mobility, able to turn over in bed. His eyesight improved so much that he could actually sit at the computer and started his own printing business.
And what do you attribute that to, eyesight?
Well, he had damage to the optic nerve caused by the multiple sclerosis, and it actually restored the damage to the nerve.
Because it's circulation.
Yes.
Because it's all about everything
circulation.
Everything is circulation. Eyesight, you get more circulation, things will heal. Boy, this is just fascinating. I can't wait to do it. Well, I'm going to do mine today. I'm going to get me 6 inches. Now, more is not better, right? 8 inches, 9 inches, not better.
I have people that swear by actually raising the bed 8 inches or 9 inches or 10 inches is actually helping them more.
But what do you think? You'd just do six?
I think you've got a trade-off between comfort and the effects on the circulation.
Mm-hmm,
so, you know, if you want to feel uncomfortable in bed, by all means, raise the bed higher.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email from Rich in Pittsburgh. Should this be done gradually, Will this increase those with high blood pressure? Any known contraindications?
Yes. Blood pressure has moved in both directions. People with low blood pressure found the blood pressure has raised. People with high blood pressure have found that the blood pressure has been lowered.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a possibility that the blood pressure could go in the wrong way, in the wrong direction, and this needs to be monitored. I would recommend that anyone trying IBT seeks advice from his or her GP and have their vital statistics monitored by the doctors, just to make sure that nothing goes awry.
Yeah, but if this is good for you, why would it possibly put it in the wrong direction? It doesn't make sense.
It's just being careful.
Oh, just being careful because, you start messing around with blood pressure and who knows.
Yes.
Yeah. Very interesting. Let's take this call. Hold on a second.
Okay.
What's your first name? Where are you calling from?
Patrick, my name is Ken and I call from Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
I want to talk to you off the air.
Okay. Well, call me later. You want to talk off the air. Go ahead. I interrupted you, Andrew.
Okay. The small group of people agreed to take part in a study of these people with multiple sclerosis. And we tilted the beds, and the results were incredible. So incredible that a charity from London, they were then called the Multiple Sclerosis Resource Centre from Essex. John and Jean Simpkins came down, interviewed this group of people with MS, and compiled a report called the Raised Bed Survey. The Raised Bed Survey didn't go into details as to what exactly happened to these people. Nevertheless, it's a very compelling read, and it does prove that it has a profound effect on people with MS. But what the report didn't state was that I had two phone calls from two ophthalmologists, one from Tynmouth and one from Paignton, asking me how putting two blocks of wood under someone's bed could restore someone's sight that was blind. And both of these patients had irreversible optic nerve damage caused through long-term progressive MS. Their eyesight was restored.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I've got a special little eye challenge because of an issue that I had some years ago, so I'll be quite interested to see if it can bring some more circulation to the retina. Mm-hmm. So just putting books under the head is going to work, right? You don't have to get fancy.
Blocks, bricks, books, if you have a bed, see, one of the problems people have is they have a really heavy bed.
Yeah.
And the frames are sometimes a little bit flimsy to be on an angle.
Sure.
So what I would recommend in that case is to buy a plywood sheet from a DIY store. These are usually 8x4 sheets, or if your bed's wider than 4 foot wide, you'll need to buy perhaps two sheets. They're not expensive. And then have some cross beams placed across the bed frame at different heights to create a wooden wedge that goes underneath the mattress. That's the safest way to tilt one of these beds.
Oh, in case you have a big bed that the frame is not real sturdy.
Yes.
Yeah, but yeah. Uh-huh. But generally,
or a complicated bed. Some of these beds have like 6 or 7 or 8 mm-hmm. legs underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And that would make tilting one of those really complicated. So the best way is to tilt the mattress.
Mm-hmm. Explain again why doing the whole incline is better than just half like they do in hospitals and nursing homes. Because it's a pressure on the spine?
Yes, but we know from many years of research that sitting's not great. Sitting's bad for us.
It's just not good for us, right?
It's not good. So if we raise the upper half of the bed, we are, in fact, getting the patient to sit in bed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's compressing the spine.
Okay.
And it's compressing the buttocks.
Yes, sir.
Yes?
Yes.
So it's doing absolutely nothing for... And the other thing is, if we're lying with the upper half raised and our legs either level or raised, it makes turning over onto our sides rather complicated because then we're bending the hip joints in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're putting stress on the hip joints as well. Whereas the inclined bed therapy, you can rotate line your back, line your side, line your tummy. And what I do recommend is recently is to raise the knees slightly. Now, what this does is it relaxes the muscles and it relaxes the tendons. So lying on your side and just raising your knees, you know, just a little bit, would actually help with the tendons and the muscles. The best case history I have now, and you're going to get some phone calls after this one, I'm sure, is I get a call from a lady who asks about bull terriers, and I said, well, what do you want to know? She said, what would an adult male be like around a severely disabled child? I said, what's the matter with your kid? She said, why do you want to know? I said, I might be able to help. She said, don't be bloody ridiculous. She said, I rang for information about a dog.
Mm-hmm.
I said, look, I can't make you listen. She said, well, spit it out. So I told her all about my research and what it had been doing for people with MS and now people with spinal cord injury, but also reporting recoveries. Not complete recoveries, but improved bowel control, bladder control, a tremendous amount of benefits. But I relayed all this onto this lady, and she told me that her girl has cerebral palsy, which is brain damage from birth. And we were told in 1995 that if she ever developed the ability to comb or brush her own hair, let us know, but don't hold your breath because it's never going to happen. And they tilted the bed, and then within a few weeks, started to get some reports saying that she's behaving a little bit differently. She seems more relaxed. A few more weeks went past. Spasms had relaxed. And this girl was wearing calipers daytimes and nighttimes to keep her legs straight. She'd never walked at the age of 12. Get another few weeks passed, get another phone call, and they're saying, well, the leg muscles are changing. They're more supple. She's not getting the spasms that she got before. Few more weeks went past, and she's turning over in bed. This couldn't happen by all accounts. And then 8 months after we tilted the bed, obviously I've got to cut the story a little bit short.
Mm-hmm.
Just had a phone call from the school. We're off down to see the girl, and she got out of the wheelchair and walked at the
school. That's fascinating. I wonder why the results get better the longer as you do it. With this inclined bed therapy, what's your theory?
Why does it take longer?
Why does it take longer and longer and get better?
I suppose it depends on the type of condition,
on the challenge that you're dealing with. Yeah,
there was a guy called Mayer who did some experiments. He severed the optic nerve in a rat and a mouse and a rabbit and a frog and a fish. Yeah, and the frog and the fish, nerve regeneration, I think it took 4 months, but the fish and the frog could see again. And what he did was he kept them in the upright position. But the rat and the mouse were able to rotate, and therefore confusion occurs. So the constant direction from gravity is not there. So that interferes with the way that the nerves... I kind of think that the nerves are behaving exactly like seedlings. They need to know which way is up and which way is down in order for them to function properly.
I wonder how the chimps and the great apes, and how do they sleep? Do we know?
Very interesting. Cattle and sheep, for example, in fields, I've noticed time and time again, if there's a hillside, they'll all be on the hillside and all of them will be facing up. A gorilla will sleep sitting up against a tree or on an angle. You know, it's very difficult to find somewhere in nature that's perfectly flat.
Yeah.
Chimps, for example, sleep in trees. They'll make a nest, and they'll be on branches that are on an angle.
With their head up, yeah, with their head up. Yeah. I've seen that, yeah. That's fantastic.
Even if we look at alligators and crocodiles, I mean, they're probably not the most intelligent species on the planet, but they use a sloping bank to regulate the body temperature.
Hmm.
So they'll face down to cool off and face up to warm up.
Fascinating. Well, Andrew, you're a very interesting man. Your website is pretty cool. We posted the original Hippocratic Oath translated from Greek on our website this morning that you had on your website. Appreciate you doing that. That's pretty interesting. Yeah, the website is inclinedbedtherapy.com. So here we are, June 23rd, 2014, and our listeners are going to try it, those who want to do it, raising their bed 6 inches, and we'll have back maybe June, July, August, you know, maybe late August or September, and we'll get them to call in and email in and let us know, and we'll talk more about it, and we'll get some reports back from our listeners around the world trying this, okay?
That sounds good to me.
How's that sound to you, sir? Well,
excellent.
Keep up the great work. We appreciate you spending an hour with us. It was just terrific. Thanks.
Patrick, thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure, sir. Bye. Okay. We're going to talk more about...